You're listening to the podcast version of Write the Book, which broadcasts every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. on the Radiator 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Joan Lee Gant, author of short stories and the new novel Wherever You Go, published by Norton. Her book of stories, An Hour in Paradise, won the Winship Pen New England Book Award and the Wallant Award for Jewish Fiction, and was a selection of the Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers program and finalist for the National Jewish Book Award. Formerly an attorney, she taught at Harvard University for 8 years. Since 2007, she has lived half the year in Tel Aviv, where she is the visiting writer at Bar-Ilan University and lectures for the U.S. State Department. When not in Israel, she lives in Newton, Massachusetts. Wherever You Go weaves together the stories of three people caught in the grip of a volatile and demanding faith. Yona Stern has traveled from New York to Israel to make amends with her estranged sister, a stoic ideologue and mother of five, who has dedicated herself to the radical West Bank settlement cause. Mark Greenglass is a respected Jerusalem Talmud teacher who was once a drug dealer saved by an 11th-hour turn to Orthodox Judaism. But for reasons he can't understand, he's lost his once fervent religious passion. Aaron Blinder is a year-abroad dropout with a history of failure whose famous father endlessly, some say obsessively, mines the Holocaust for his best-selling melodramatic novels. Desperate for approval, Aaron finds a home on the violent fringe of Israeli society with unforeseen and devastating consequences. Wherever You Go shines a light on one of the most disturbing elements in Israeli society, Jewish extremist groups and their threat to the modern democratic state. I spoke to Joan Lee Gant in November. I began by asking her to talk about how a story or a novel tends to start for her.
I'm one of these writers who does not work things out ahead of time in my head. I start either a story, well, certainly a short story, a little more focused, I would say, in a little more focused way. I will start with just literally a few sentences or one sentence. Just start with a line. And or occasionally I've started, like, with a title I dreamed up, or occasionally a visual image or something like that. But I'll just start writing. I don't think about any of this stuff ahead of time because I find that doesn't work for me. If I think about things ahead of time, I just tend to veto them.
Okay.
Yeah, and say, oh, that's not interesting, or I try to spin it out too quickly in my head. So I've learned to more or less trust that it'll come out in the writing.
Uh-huh.
So that's really where I start.
Does that mean that it's a little bit slower going than if you were to plan it out ahead of time, or do you still tend to write fairly efficiently, or how would you say it goes, the process?
Right. Well, and I also probably should have added that, you know, with the novel, well, this is the only novel I've published. It's really the only one I've really fully written, the one that you have in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
So that also started not with a lot of ideas and thoughts about what it would be, but just sort of a general idea of where it would be set and which and who it might be about in a very most general idea. Like, I just knew I was going to write a novel set in Israel, and it would be about Americans in Israel. So that was the extent to which I knew what I knew ahead of time, and then I just began to write about people I began to make up on the page. So when you asked about whether that's slow going, it is slow going in the sense that, you know, you don't really know from day to day, or I don't know from day to day, or from writing session to writing session, what might be next. Occasionally I might have a note to myself for the next day, but it's slow going in the sense that I don't have it planned, and therefore I can make lots of wrong turns and try out all kinds of directions that I eventually, you know, that don't work. But I don't think it's terribly slow going in the sense that when I'm sitting there writing, it just comes when it comes.
Okay.
It doesn't come every day, but, you know, when it comes, it's fast. It's just that I have no idea where it's going to go, what it's going to be, and what it will, you know, eventually amount to. And so I am a slow writer compared to some. I mean, it took a long time to write the stories that I've written, and it took a long time to write that novel. But I'm not sure it would be a whole lot faster if I was the type that planned it out. Maybe so, but I'm just, it's not even a choice for me. I just simply can't do it the other way. So I've learned to just go with this way of doing things. And so I can't even compare whether it would be faster or slower if it was mapped out. But it just, I can't even imagine working in a kind of planned out way.
Yeah, yeah. Now, this book has three main characters whose narratives are sort of interwoven, and then at a certain point they become intertwined a little bit more. I wonder if you can talk about choosing or maybe even just finding these characters and these storylines and how they came together for you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when I started to write the book, as I said, I knew that I wanted to write about young Americans in Israel because I just was curious to find out. It was a discovery process for me. I wanted to find out what happened to them, what are the influences and the pushes and the pulls and what goes on for them there. And that's partly because I've spent a lot of time in Israel and I'm just kind of endlessly curious to see how it affects Americans who are there. So I began to write a story about a group of young women that were there, and they were all taking a certain kind of path toward embracing a religious lifestyle. On the periphery of their story were a couple of young men that were interesting, but they were very much on the periphery. And I finished that story about this group of young women, and I actually turned it into I gave it to my agent, and I turned it into my editor at W.W. Norton because I had a contract for this book. And my editor said it was fine, but it was kind of flat, and I agreed with her. The story was all the women were so very well-adjusted, and they had good sense of humor, and they were all very pleasant, and it wasn't that dramatic.
Right.
But on the fringe, I saw these men who were really very disturbed and very dramatic, I thought. I thought they had a lot of potential. So I agreed with the editor, and I could tell as I was writing that the story was just, it was not coming out. It was something about the quality of it. So I pulled those two of those male characters from the fringe, I pulled them forward, and I started to write their story. And they revealed quite interesting stuff. So I started to write their story, and then I kept one of the women from that original story for a long time. And I saw that I had three stories that were going to overlap around an incident that one of them does in the book. And I had that incident after a little while. I still had those characters. But at one point, I gave the manuscript to a friend, two friends actually, to read, who didn't even know each other. And they both came back with the same advice that the book was coming along, the story was coming along, those men were really interesting, but what was this woman doing in the book? She just didn't seem to fit. And she didn't. I had to kind of send her back to her original story and come up with another woman who would play the part, so to speak, of that female character that I had imagined. And then I came up with the woman who's now in the book. So she's the first character that readers meet, but she was the last one I wrote.
Oh, okay.
So by then, I had sort of a story underway. I had the main incident in the book that sort of brings all the characters together and is sort of the pivotal moment in the book. I had that fairly early on, and I kept it as a prologue. Although I had the sense it might not remain as a prologue, I knew it was the most sort of pivotal event in the book and that everything in the book had to either lead up to that event or be the fallout of that event. And so I wrote around that. I wrote these character stories knowing that this event was there, not knowing how it would bring the characters together, and I had no idea how that event, you know, what kind of fallout it would bring about, but I knew that it happened and that my sense was that that's what my interest was. So eventually I wrote all the material, and I then decided that that shouldn't be a prologue, that it wouldn't be that interesting for the reader to know about it so early on, and that I wanted to put it more in the middle of the book. And then I endlessly played with the weaving of the stories. As you said, they're woven together. And I had the three character stories that I wasn't sure should the reader have 50 pages of character A before they meet character B, or should they have 12 pages of that? You know, what would the experience be like for the reader? I wanted to try to figure out to go from one character to another. And so I tried all kinds of things, including the manuscript was all over the floor in pieces, you know, to see what it would look like visually if I had different sections in different places. At one point, I had a clothesline in my office, and I clipped sections of the novel on clothespins to see where pieces might go, because I almost needed to visually construct it, not just imagine the storylines, but kind of visually imagine how that would lay out for a reader. So yeah. I moved that around quite a lot.
And it's so interesting because as a writer, you're probably so close to the narrative that you really can't visualize it as words on the page after a certain point. You really need to see it in another way in order to balance it. Is that true for you?
It sounds like. I mean, you're continually having to write and you're so up close and then you have to walk away from it. And people talk about how they have to let manuscripts cool. People put them away for a while. They put them in a drawer or they, you know, depending on what the luxury of their time is, people do put things away for a while. And in the course of writing this book, which was really written over essentially a 7-year period, there were large chunks, in particular, I would say two of them, where there was one period where I didn't look at this manuscript for almost 8 months.
Oh, wow.
I was working on it, and I had a medical problem which impacted my vision, and I put it aside. And then the vision was resolving, but then I went overseas to teach, and I brought it with me, but I never looked at it during that very busy teaching period. And when I came back from the teaching gig, it had been about 8 months, and immediately I knew what to do with the rest of the book, but I really needed to get away from it. In fact, I've often wondered if my vision was, my body was telling me that it was going a little blind with this book, and I needed to get away from it for a while. I was sort of forced to, but my faculties were telling me. So that, you know, you're absolutely right. And it happens all the time, you know, with everybody who works.
Right. I have a question about the group of women that your readers said were coming across as a little bit flat. Mm-hmm. On your website, you have a little piece where you mentioned that when you began writing fiction, you mostly wrote about men for a period of time because women and women's stories felt too close and too hard maybe to get at. And I'm wondering if you think that might be what was going on with the group of women.
Yeah, I think there were a couple of things going on in retrospect that I see were going on with that draft. One of them was a craft issue, which I've now gotten a little perspective on. I was writing it from a kind of omniscience, almost, and with quite a bit of distance, almost like a humor. There was sort of a wry humor and an omniscient this voice that was, I liked. It was rather appealing and funny, and it was charming, but it was also making for enormous distance between the reader and the characters. I was just keeping it kind of too high up. And it was just hard to sink into those characters. And I think in some ways it was a little bit of a defense. I was writing from this omniscient voice to keep distance from the characters because I myself was uncomfortable getting too close to them.
Mm.
So I sort of chose a voice that I couldn't manage terribly well as a writer at that point because it was... I wasn't sure what the story was, and it was too distant, and which is nothing like what the story ultimately turned out to be, which is very sort of close third person, and which is what most of my short stories have been. So I think my only way of handling these female characters was to do it with this great distance, which wasn't working terribly well, you know, from a story point of view. And I think that was in part because of that I was writing about a group of women. I have since finishing this novel, I've gone back to some stories I had started some years before, and I have been excited about going back to short stories because I like writing short stories, and it's a nice change from spending all those years on one project.
Right.
And these are wildly different from me. They're first-person stories. I never wrote in first-person before, and they all involve women, and they're very difficult. I mean, they're emotionally difficult, too. I'm not letting myself get away with anything this time. There's no distance here. So, I think that's been something of an evolution and a challenge for me as a writer to write about women and to dig deep. The stories, the novel that you're talking about in my earlier short stories deal with a lot of issues of people interested in their relationship with the divine and spiritual needs and spiritual desires. And that's been very engaging to me. But I feel that I'm ready to move away from that as a very sort of deep, motivating factor for people, and to get to somewhat other, more personal desires and needs. You know, mm-hmm. They're all around desire, but they're different kinds of desires that I find myself exploring now.
Yeah.
And and I think that was the problem with women. I did publish one story about in first person about women, and it was funny. I mean, I was sort of incapable of writing about women without being funny, and it was it worked for a while, but it was keeping me from delving into slightly more deeper, difficult material.
Now, this question may almost lead to something the exact opposite, which is one character in Wherever You Go is Mark Greenglass, and he's a Talmud teacher and a former drug dealer who's been saved by religion. And in a favorite story of mine that you wrote, which is called How to Comfort the Sick and Dying, you had a character named Reuven Schweller, if I'm saying that right, and he was a former drug user that was saved by religion. And I was struck by your return to that situation in creating Mark. Were you maybe not quite finished with Reuven?
Absolutely, you're right. They are one and the same in a lot of ways. That's the same issue. And I was surprised myself because I wrote that original story. I also liked that story a lot, and I felt, okay, I've explored that question of someone being saved by religion. What does that mean to them? And then I began to write about this guy, and sure enough, in his case, it's been 14 years since he's become the guy in the novel. It's 14 years since he became religious. But now he's at the other end of the spectrum where he's lost his religious passion, and he doesn't know why, and neither did I, and I had to write about it. But I was exploring the very same phenomenon of the attraction of religion, the capacity of a religious life to sort of rescue somebody, to save somebody. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't done with the character in the short story. You're right.
Yeah, yeah. And they both are just such beautiful storylines. I so loved that story, How to Comfort the Sick and Dying, and the conflict that's created by his nominally being available to help someone else, but in fact, you know, it turns out that he's very helped too. I thought that was a beautiful situation to write a story about. I was going to ask you, what did you learn about extremism as you wrote this book? There's at least one storyline that's very closely related to extremism.
Yes, that was really interesting for me. When I look at that book now and I describe it, and I sometimes describe it in a, you know, the short version where I'll say this is a book that takes as its subject, you know, the phenomenon of Jewish extremism, political and religious extremism.
Right.
And I'm aware that I didn't set out to explore that. As I said, I wanted to just follow some characters and see where they went, but it's not an accident that they pulled me straight into the heart of these kinds of questions. Because I've long been interested in sort of radicals and what allows people to become radicals and what drives people toward extremist activity and what allows people to justify violence in the name of their cause. And the cause could be religion, it could be politics, it could be other kinds of things. And I'm of an age where I'm kind of a child of the 60s. I was in college in the late 60s and early 70s when there were all kinds of things going on campuses, and there was the Weathermen and SDS, and people who are attracted to these causes always interested me, and I actually admire people that are attracted to causes and want to live for the movement and the cause. I could never do that, but I also have often wondered what, there's a bit of a blindness in there that I've been interested in exploring that makes somebody able to commit themselves without being concerned about the consequences to others. So I've been attracted to explore that, and but I hadn't explored it in my writing. But sure enough, it came up in this book because the book was set in Israel, and I've spent a lot of time as an adult there. I lived there in the late 1970s. I used to be a lawyer, and I went to Israel as a young lawyer. And I thought I'd stay for 6 months, and I stayed for 3 years. And then since 2007, I was invited to be a visiting instructor at a university there to teach writing, and they've kept inviting me back, so I've gone now. I'll be leaving in January for my fifth time, and so I've been there for half a year, roughly half a year, you know, 4 or 6 months, since 2007. And the phenomenon of extremism, of course, is all over the news in Israel, and it's all over the news now for all, you know, the whole world is, mm-hmm. is dealing with the phenomenon of religious extremism. So I had a long interest in this anyway for decades, this phenomenon of people who are committed to their movements. And then in Israel, Jewish extremism is very much part of the conversation in Israel. Israelis are very worried about this phenomenon. So I was drawn to exploring that. And when you asked about what did I learn, you know, when you write fiction, you discover, you learn as the writer, you explore it through fiction, but you're exploring a factual thing or a real thing just through the lens of fiction or through the imagined characters. I found that I learned a few things. One is it seemed to me, and I did a fair amount of research as well, but it seemed to me that something I had suspected as a younger person back in my college days, that number one, a lot of psychology is behind extremist activity. That's a lot of what happens in the book. There's a certain amount that's ideology, but there's also a certain amount that's psychology mm-hmm. that drives certain individuals to embrace radicalism or extremist causes. And I was interested in exploring that. I found the rhetoric to be fascinating, chilling, but fascinating.
Right.
So found myself, you know, yeah, drawn to that. You know, I had the opportunity through research in Israel to sort of look at one particular kind of extremism, which is the extremism in the most hardline Jewish radical communities in Israel. But it's very similar to religious extremists all over the place.
Right.
You know, it's not a surprise to people. And people often talk about, you know, the most extremist the most extremist schools that sort of promote extremist thinking in Muslim communities, these madrasas, they teach things that are very similar to what the most extremist yeshivas are teaching young Jewish kids in these most radical communities, these most hardline, I don't mean, you know, radical in the sense of really violent radicalism.
Right.
So I found this to be also something I discovered.
One of your storylines follows a boy, a young man named Aaron, who becomes involved in one of these Jewish extremist groups. And as I was reading your story of Aaron, I was curious. I'll back up a minute. In my own writing, I've had like a storyline where somebody did something because she's mentally ill, and I remember feeling a little bit like I wanted to explain her background without making everything all about, you know, this leads to that. So I was wondering, in creating a background for Aaron, did you feel like it was difficult to balance giving him a plausible background? And I thought it worked very well, just so you know. I'm just curious, in creating him, was it hard to find the right background for Aaron to help, you know, explain what he's doing without explaining it away?
Right. Great question, and a big problem in terms of writing, because I had the same issue. I understand exactly what you're saying about the character you created with her own mental illness background, which was I've been, you know, writing a pretty long time, and I've been there before where you want to, you know, you want the actions to speak for themselves, and you can see it in your own early writing, or I see it in student writing, where people try to do the cause and effect so obviously that it's just, you know, as you say, it's too obvious, and it's overtelling it, and you don't want to line up a sort of, well, you know, it's because of A that B is happening, mm-hmm. because the really interesting thing is the B is what's happening.
Yeah.
So, but on the other hand, if you don't give the character some background that makes their behavior plausible, then the reader will throw the book across the room and say,
exactly.
you know what, I don't understand why this person's behaving this way, right?
Exactly.
And so I had written quite a bit of the background about Aaron, but during the course of writing the book. But when I was finishing the draft, I took a lot of it out for that reason, because I thought I was hoping that his conduct would laced in with a little bit of just enough of his thinking and so forth would be sufficient. But when my editor at Norton, you know, did a couple of readings of the book, and one of the first things she said in her first read through was, I need to know more about this kid's background. I need to know why he's doing this.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had written it, so I knew it, but I didn't want to put it in there in that, you know, most obvious, well, of course, you know, it's because of this that he does that way. So I did have to work with that, where I had to put more of it in, but I didn't want it to be so neatly explained away. Because I think there's another issue here, too, which is just there's not only the issue of plausibility from the point of view of your writing and your characters have to be plausible. There's also the question of people's behaviors. Like, you can cast around and find all kinds of reasons for why we do the things we do, but they're really never sufficient. You know, there's... Why, just because he has background A doesn't mean he would do behavior B, just like your own siblings. You know, you all grow up in the same house and you don't all do the same things. So I really shy away from kind of a simplistic explanation of behavior, because I think the behavior is more interesting than the reasons for it sometimes. Right. But you have to include both. So... It was definitely, it's a great question, because nobody's ever asked me that.
This is just a general question about writing. Have you ever started a novel and then stopped because you decided that it wasn't something that you wanted to stick with over time, because it is such an investment to write a novel?
Yeah, sure. I did. I started a novel when I was in the Vermont College program where you and I met.
Yes.
But it was before I met you. I was still a student in the program, and I started a novel, and I worked on it for, I think, a year or two, and then I saw it just was not really going to be something I wanted to stay with. So I put it aside, and then at another point, some years later, I started another one. And I can't even really... Oh, yes, right. And I put that aside. Oh, I just remembered. And I started a third. I've had a number of half-cooked pieces that I did not finish. And, it's a good thing I have a healthy amnesia, because I can't believe I was willing to try another one. I spent several years on the most recent one. I still have, I must have 1,000 pages of material on that one.
Yeah.
But I thought it wasn't going anywhere. I guess one of the ways I've consoled myself, because I've had to say this to other people occasionally, like students or somebody who might ask for some kind of encouragement, that I have to view it as never a waste, that it's just, you're still writing, and it's all eventually goes into the next work, and it's all, you know, good so-called practice, and so, that's a good question, and I guess the answer is like 3 or 4 of them.
Yeah. Now, it's never a waste of creative energy, but I know that you came to writing fiction somewhat late, and
yes.
And I know a lot of people who are in their 40s and 50s and they're writing fiction, and so it's not a waste of creative energy, but sometimes it might feel like, you know, a waste of time.
You're very aware of the mortality issue when you probably are anyway, even if you come to writing in your 20s, but I didn't start writing fiction until I was 40, and now I'm 60. And I feel like I look back and say, well, great, you know, I published a story collection, I was 53, and I published this novel when I was 60. But, I don't know how much time I have left. On the other hand, you know, there have certainly been lots of promising writers who die young or stop writing young.
Exactly.
So you never know what you have. I agree with you that you can feel like you're wasting your time, but there was kind of nothing I could do about it.
Right.
It was what it was, and that was sort of my process. On the plus side, this mortality hanging over me does provide, and perhaps again it would provide the same if I was 31 years old, but I do have a real sense of urgency on a couple of levels. One is that the material I write about has to really matter. Not just to me, but it has to matter to me a lot, and I have to feel like it matters. And the second is that I have this sense of urgency I don't have any patience with sentences that are garbage. I mean, I have to write them, just like everybody has to write them, but I really try hard, even in my early drafts, just to really be honest with myself, like, and bear down and avoid the shortcuts that could be tempting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wonderful to hear that you published for the first time at 53 and that you published a novel at 60. I think that's very helpful to people who haven't yet. So.
Yeah. And you know, I've been meeting more and more wonderful writers who, you know, just started later. And I think it's fine. I have no, you know, and it's actually, writing is a great thing you can do until the end, really. You know, you don't, it's not
sure.
like ballet dancing where you really have to quit at a certain
yeah.
age. You know, you can write till you can't write anymore.
Right.
So it's a great thing to do in any stage of life.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think there are a lot of myths. I mean, I actually have a little talk I've given in a few venues about the myths of the writing life. And one of those myths is that you're a born writer, and if you're not writing when you're 20 or 22, then there's something wrong with you. You're not the real thing. And that's just... That, to me, that's silly. That just disregards real life and the circumstances of everybody's individual situation. So if one can get past those myths and decide that it's just a lot of noise, then you can just go ahead and do your work.
Right. Well, now, you mentioned that you used to be a lawyer. So I'm wondering how, if at all, how does that serve your work writing fiction? Do you feel that that was something that became useful in another way that maybe was unexpected?
Yeah, no, you know, I mean, I can read the contract the publisher sent me. You know, people say, how does it work? I would have to say that... I don't write. This book actually had a little bit of legal process in it, which I was surprised because I had been writing for a long time. And the very first workshop I ever took was in my community here. I had little kids, and there was a noontime writing workshop in the area that I got a babysitter for. And I remember the instructor, a wonderful man named Art Edelstein, who taught at Brandeis for many years. He said, "Oh, I see you're a lawyer. You're going to write about legal things?" And I thought, "Are you kidding? Never. It'll never make its way into my work." So for 20 years it didn't, but then it did surface a little. There's a little bit of sort of legal wrangling in this book.
Yeah.
And it's coming up a little bit in some of the work I'm doing now, but I would say that I haven't chosen it particularly as a subject. You know, I don't know if it had anything, you know, if it's contributed much to the writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a discipline. I have mastered a certain kind of discipline, and I'm somewhat particular about sentences and stuff, but I don't actually, the jury's out on that, to use a metaphor or a pun.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Wherever You Go. Mm-hmm. Some of the story surprised me. I've never been to Israel. Mm-hmm. It surprised me to read about the way that some Israelis or Americans living full-time in Israel and probably planning to stay there would judge Americans who come to visit or come briefly.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit and what
sure.
that is about?
Sure. That's kind of like a little hot button because when the book came out, I went to lots of Jewish communities to give book talks, and mostly were synagogues or Jewish community centers. And there were people who had read the book or in the room, you know, who said, "Wow, you know, you really skewered a couple of these Jewish tour groups that come, or, you know, what about this question of people who come to visit and have a view of Israel that is perhaps naive or so forth?" I did find myself interested in writing about that. I guess it's somewhat, let's see, how shall I put it? I've been on both ends.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I'll put it. I've been at both ends. My first stay in Israel, which did extend into 3 years, I was aware at the time. I was 28. I wasn't a kid. And I was aware of tour groups and so forth, people who came and had the kind of, you know, image or a fantasy about Israel. And, you know, it's partly a function of just being a tourist, and it's a function of sort of growing up Jewish in America, depending on what era you grow up in. You learn things about Israel, and Israel has a very heroic early story that people who grew up in the 50s and 60s would have heard. And so there's, you know, that element that I was aware of when I was in Israel, of people on these short-term visits. And then, of course, being on the other end, coming back and living in the United States and going to visit, I would see both, you know, coming again as a tourist myself, so to speak. There's a lot of, I think, naivete. There has been, let's just say, naivete in the American community about Israel in some ways, that it's sort of inevitable. I mean, if you don't live anywhere, it's the same, I guess, when people visit any country.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to know the ins and outs of everything. But the way in which it probably comes about in this book that makes it a little different is that there are some fundraising things that are going on. This community isn't an episode where a group from Cleveland comes and they're visiting a settlement and they're asked to contribute, and they do. And this is something that I am very attuned to, that the situation in Israel politically, without getting into a long, you know, sort of soapbox rant here on your show, but it's very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And I myself have strong feelings about the settlement enterprise as very problematic. And I think that many American Jews, and I've discovered this by being on the road and being out at book tours, when American Jewish communities hear about the degree of problem, the problematic elements of the settlement enterprise, and especially with the far right wing groups, they are very disturbed as well. So they don't necessarily want their money to go to support these kinds of activities and these settlements. And when people hear the full spectrum, they want more information. So there's in the book, you know, there is a group that comes and automatically writes checks to support these settlements, because these are people who've been loyal to Israel for a long time. But my feeling is that if people knew more about the situation, they might be less willing to support those activities. Now, there are plenty of other really worthy things people can still support in Israel. There's lots of organizations that are working toward peace, that are working towards civil liberties, and toward, you know, other really important and wonderful things going on in the country that will enhance its democracy and its peacemaking with its neighbors. But there is a degree to which that has the sort of information about Israel has not always come across to American Jews who would like, you know, who are just not hearing at all.
Right. So. Well, and it sounds like it's a little bit naive to consider Israel a single thing, even a single symbol, because for a lot of Americans, Israel is a symbol, and they probably visit with this sense of belonging, but not understanding that it is, you know, it's made up of all different groups and peoples. And,
Right. And it's, you know, it's a very complicated place, and just like every place is a complicated place, but American Jews have a different relationship with Israel than they might have visiting another country. So there is, like you say, a part of everyone has their own projections as well and their own fantasies.
I'm curious what people's reactions are and perhaps assumptions about you and who you are when they read the book, either people who know you well or people who don't know you at all. But like you say, you've been on both sides of certain issues. So do people make the assumption that you think a certain thing or another certain thing because it's covered in this book?
That's a good question. I don't actually know. I don't know what people think of me. I kind of don't want to know. but I don't know what people think of me, except that I think that people can discern or divine, let's say, my politics a bit about certain aspects. You know, I think most people will assume that there's, for example, there's an Israeli in the book, and one person wrote to me, I think, I don't recall whether it was an interview or a book group, was he the mouthpiece of my political position? And he's the one who said something like, look, there are two narratives here. Both sides have to hear each other's side, and, you know, nobody can get exactly what they want. You know, that kind of pragmatism.
Right.
So there are pieces in the book that probably a reader could divine would be my political position around, say, the Arab-Israeli conflict or the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And so I think one can make those assumptions, but that's fair enough because it's accurate, and that's okay. And one of the early reviews made me realize what I had done. The person wrote, "This is a political book," and I thought, "Oh, I wrote a political book." You know, I'm a fiction writer, and like I said, I set out to write stories. I wasn't planning on exploring a quote issue or a theme, but I did, and so I stand by that. And it is a political book, but you know, I don't think anybody would think I'm sympathetic to the settlement cause if you read through this book.
Right.
But I hope that people will be able to read the book not as a tract, but as a piece of fiction. But it's fair enough if people make a certain assumption about my politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think the book does present lots of different points of view. I'm just wondering if, because it is such a charged subject, if people will just see one side of it because they're very emotional about it.
Yeah, and that certainly has happened. There have been people who have been angry, and there have been occasionally angry reviews that are very clear to me that I know what they're angry about. I mean, there was one that was just blatant, and the reviewer was a settler who said, "She's after the settlements, you know, this is what she wrote." And there was another very interesting review, a very nice review from a very prominent Jewish writer in a Jewish newspaper who said, "This is a very well-written book, and I've been there, and she's depicting something accurate. I just wish she hadn't written it," because the writer was uncomfortable with my revealing or, you know, sort of shining a light on this subject. So it certainly is touchy for people in that regard, and I know that. Interestingly, though, the reception in Israel, at least in the English language press in Israel, has been very positive. Israelis are used to this material. It's this phenomenon of extremism is in the news and on documentaries and on TV and in the newspapers all the time.
Right.
And they're dealing with it all the time. It's not a surprise to them to hear the rhetoric of these most extreme settlers or to have to wrestle with the difficulties of this. So I got some very positive reviews, including some that said, really nice one that said, "Hard to believe she's not a native Israeli. She got her finger on the pulse," which is what you worry about when you're writing about another. Yeah, well, you worry that you're exploiting another culture for your art and, you know, not doing it. Not portraying it with sensitivity. But apropos of the sort of sensitivity, the Israelis, in the Israeli press, it was, you know, nothing new. It wasn't a surprise, and didn't hit people in that way that it might upset some readers here who would say it's sensitive material.
Right. Well, now, speaking about exploiting, you know, a subject or a people, I was interested to see that Aaron's father writes novels about the Holocaust. I found that very, very interesting, that his whole line is never forget, never forget. But he's really not writing anything very useful or respectful of all that was lost. So I just wonder if you can talk about developing his character just a little bit.
Yeah, you know, the father figure there, it's been a very interesting thing to consider now after the book is done, and occasionally I've talked to like a writer's group, a reading group, book group, and, you know, hear people who really want to engage very specifically with pieces of the book. And Aaron's father is one of those interesting points to discuss. He's a writer who, as you said, he exploits the Holocaust for sort of these melodramatic potboilers that he churns out, and he makes a living off of it. And he knows he's not a very good writer. He knows he's sacrificed if he had other talent, you know, just to make a living, and this is his subject. But the whole question of the exploiting the Holocaust for any kind of art or literature or commercial use is just something I'm interested in. I think it's something important to think about. There's lots, and it is occasionally something I've heard come up at a panel or other sort of literary type of discussion among, in say, contemporary Jewish literature, is what about writing about the Holocaust? There are lots of writers who write fiction about the Holocaust, and every now and then I'll read an interview with a writer who'll say that it was almost as if they had just discovered it, which it actually gives me a little bit of a chill, you know, that it just discovered it because it's like dramatic material. And that's a little problematic. Again, however, it doesn't mean one can't write about it. And the bar has been set very high, and for the most part, I think contemporary writers have have written at that high bar. You know, 50 years ago, you could, or 30 years ago, you could write about the Holocaust more sentimentally, and it wouldn't be so bad. But it's now people are sophisticated, and it's like any subject that has inherent sort of sensationalism. You have to be very careful about how you write about it. So I just think it's was worth kind of. It was important to me to somehow do something to this father. I found what he was doing. He was a problematic father. He was not a good father, mm-hmm. and I held him responsible for his son's behavior in the end. But he also was writing things that were essentially almost inflammatory. When you write about a subject, it's not that. Is going to have an effect on your readers if it's political. You have to expect that some of your readers are going to go away with a certain, almost like incitement. I mean, that's how I found this father's work to be. Mm-hmm. And I felt that he had a responsibility to handle his subject. I think that people who write about the Holocaust do have to be careful of how they use it, so to speak.
You have to have a certain responsibility in how you treat the material.
Yeah.
It just seems so important.
Which is, you know, not to say you can't use it and you don't write about it, but you have to think about what it is you want to do with this material and not use it just for its inherent drama. Mm-hmm. And also because you know you're going to, and also on a very cynical level, because you know you're going to have a readership or a market for it. You have to, you know, be careful about that.
Yeah.
So, and I think, you know, it's an analogy, which I hope doesn't offend anybody on any side of this discussion, but there's an analogy that comes to mind is occasionally people writing about sexual abuse or incest stories, or, you know, you see that in fiction as well. Those also have to be well written. You can't rely on just the inherent sensationalism or the drama or the prurient interest to make your work worthwhile. And I think it's a similar type of thing. There is one can see almost a prurient interest at mm-hmm. work in some Holocaust material. So with all these things, you have to have a degree of, like you say, responsibility.
I wanted to ask you if you could speak a little bit about your publishing experience. I know that you first published a collection of short stories, An Hour in Paradise is the title of that collection, and then now you have Wherever You Go, the novel published. So was that a two-book deal, or were those separate things? How did you approach getting published?
Sure. So the story collection was published first, but before the collection was published, there were 10 stories in that book, and 9 of them had been published in literary journals before that, before it became a book. And that turned out to be a good thing, because then it was a lot easier to put them together and interest an agent, and then it was easier for the agent to interest the publisher, because the stories had been published, and 7 of 6 or whatever, a number of them had won either a prize or they were a finalist in a prize.
Wow.
From a literary journal. So the stories had kind of, I was fortunate that the stories had a nice track record, so that when I put them together in a book, and they were somewhat thematically related in that they all involved Jewish characters or Jewish situations of one kind or another, so they worked together as a book. So, as I say, so the stories were published, and they had received some recognition, so I was able to interest an agent pretty easily. I did the usual query letters to lots of agents, like everybody does, but I had interest from several, and I selected a very excellent and seasoned agent named Elaine Markson, who mm-hmm. was very, just very wonderful to work with. And then she sold the book to W.W. Norton, the short stories, and Norton said they wanted a two-book contract, which meant for a novel. And I didn't have a novel going on at the time, and it was sort of a leap for me. I really didn't plan to write a novel, but, well, you know, what the heck, I had the contract, and I would give it a try. And I say that sort of, you know, kind of cavalierly now, but at the time, I just thought, well, I'll try writing a novel. But Norton did not say they would hold up the publication of the stories until the novel was done, which sometimes happens for people. I was very lucky. So they published the stories, and they said, you know, turn in your novel whenever. So it was a two-book contract. I actually found writing under a contract, so the stories came out, but then I was working on the novel, and And as I indicated earlier, I wrote some other novels in between. I wrote first an earlier draft of this novel with a slightly different story, and one of the novels that I never really finished was also originally going to be in fulfillment of this contract. So I struggled with actually writing a good enough novel to complete this contract, and I found actually writing under a contract a little hard.
Okay.
I know it sounds, you know, it can sound quite spoiled and privileged because people are very happy to have a contract, but at one point, when my agent turned in an earlier version of this book, I thought I was off the contract, and I kind of sighed I gave a big sigh of relief, because I found it a little bit constricting psychologically. I don't know why. But in the end, when I finished the draft, the publisher viewed me as still on the contract, so I was able to write it thinking I wasn't on the contract anymore, and then when it was time to sell it, I had a contract, so I had kind of the best of both worlds. it was a sort of psychological problem of my own, of just feeling a little bit constrained.
Right.
And I don't really know why. So I had this, as I say, I had a two-book contract with Norton, and that's how the publishing came about.
Okay. All right. Great. What are you working on now?
I'm working on some stories that I had started years before that were started early on when I was finishing up this novel or in the revision stages that I just never finished, these stories that I'm enjoying. And I'm also working on a larger project that I had started a few years ago, just very tentatively. Can't say much about it because it's very early.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Who are some of your favorite authors, Joan?
Yeah, always a great question. I have a lot of favorite authors. I don't always read them all the time, but I'm a big fan of Bernard Malamud and mm-hmm. Tobias Wolff, Amy Bloom, William Maxwell, William Trevor. These are they're short stories primarily, the ones that are popping into my mind. And right now I'm really enjoying reading Binocular Vision by Edith Perlman, who is a Boston area writer who was one of the National Book Award finalists, and Edith published her first collection of stories at age 60.
Oh, wow.
And is a very prolific writer. She's published hundreds of stories, and she's in her 70s, and she's a wonderful writer, writes with tremendous restraint and humor and wisdom and beautiful stories. So she's a current favorite.
And she was a finalist for the award for which,
yep,
for this collection?
Yep, called Binocular Vision.
Oh,
and it
great.
Was just, you know, the award ceremony that happened just last week.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's her third or fourth collection, and published by a very small press called Lookout Press. In fact, I think it might be their first book that they put out.
Is that University of North Carolina, Lookout Press?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. When you were talking before about how your stories all had some Jewish theme or content, and that made them enough of a piece to sell as a collection of stories, what about people whose stories don't necessarily have a lot in common one from the next? Do you think that makes it a lot harder?
Well, I don't know. I mean, people sometimes say that, but I read lots of story collections where there's no obvious overarching commonality of like that. And I think that, I don't think that should hold people back. I think that people have been scared by the publishing industry saying, well, everything has to be a linked story.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the recent award winners like Olive Kittredge and some other books where, or occasionally a book has been marketed as a novel when the readers can tell it's a lot of short stories, but they happen to just involve the same characters. I think writers have been frightened into thinking that unless you're writing linked stories with all the same characters or all the same material or the same country or state or something, then nobody will want to buy it. But I don't think we should operate that way. And there are lots of wonderful collections out there with many different kinds of stories. I mean, the collection I just mentioned by Edith Perlman, Binocular Vision, is actually some new and collected stories of hers, but they range all over the map in terms of what they're about, who they're about, and all of her collections have been like that. So I think that, you know, good stories that are well written, I don't think it should matter.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, I mean, certainly not to force a linking of stories when it's not there. If somebody's already writing linked stories or stories that happen to involve the same types of thematic material, that's fine, but not to force it. I wouldn't say that that should hold somebody back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't speak from the publishing side, but just as a reader and an observer.
All right. Well, so, Joan, I just have one last question for you.
Sure.
I wondered if you have advice that you can offer to writers who possibly write about what I'm calling sort of charged subjects, either in a social or cultural or political realm. The way that you wrote about extremism in this book, you know, there are other subjects that might be in that same realm.
Yeah. I'd say great. I'd say go with it. Because, first of all, if that's what you want to write, you know, you should write what you want to write. But I have to say that my experience of writing something charged has been all good. And it's been actually very affirming to me as a writer that fiction writers, for one thing, people in the publishing world will often say, you know, nonfiction sells better than fiction. And if you try to get book talks, you know, you hear people say, well, people don't want to come out and listen to a fiction writer. But when people write about a subject of some significance, that changes the dynamic, for one thing. So I think if anything, it's an enhancement to like the, you know, the promotion and the publishing, is if you write material, if you're genuinely interested, you're not forcing it. So I wouldn't view that as a negative at all. And the other is that it's what I had said earlier about, I feel like there's not just we all have a limited amount of time, but readers, we have to kind of earn the attention of readers. And if your material is charged because it's significant, then that's important.
Mm-hmm.
I think better to write about things that matter than things that don't, which doesn't mean that uncharged material doesn't matter. You can just, you know, look at a mild life and find that it's meaningful, and of course it is. But if your material is charged and significant to you, that's a really great advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
So I would say go with it and stay with your vision and don't be afraid.
Yeah.
And don't be afraid of your exposure. You're going to be exposed anyway. So you might as well, you know, stand by what you've written, and I think it's a great thing.
Okay. All right. Well, Joan, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciate it.
Sure. My pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Joan Legant. To learn more about her work, visit www.joanlegant.com, and her last name is spelled L-E-E-G-A-N-T. Today I have two Write the Book prompts to suggest, both of which were generously offered by my guest, Joan Legant. First, write titles, maybe 10 of them. Pick one and start writing. Let the title you've come up with and chosen out of your 10 be the impetus that feeds what you write. Joan's second suggestion is to read someone else's book for an hour and then write 10 first lines of your own. Pick one and go from there. Reading another book first will put your mind into the language of fiction and can help to feed the first lines that you write. A copy of these prompts will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with these exercises, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about the station is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro. You've been listening to a special podcast edition of the show that airs on The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.